kind of stuff we don't tolerate. They had gunshot wounds and everything, and their heads were gone, and somebody's doing something that should not ever be done.
Federal officials investigate the deaths of 24 walrus on the northwest coast. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a race in Fairbanks highlights a rare genetic disorder.
Use the symbolism of the equinox in the balance of light and dark to raise awareness about Usher syndrome.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
25 walrus, including up to a dozen calves, have been found dead on a beach about 40 miles north of Point Hope. Now, federal wildlife officials are investigating a possible criminal slaughter of the protected marine mammals. KNOM's Matthew Smith reports.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says they received an email about the walrus deaths last week. They were found just off of Cape Lisburn, not far from a small manned Air Force radar site, now serving as the basis for the Federal Wildlife Agency's investigation. Many of the animals were found headless, their tusks apparently harvested, and locals say some carcasses were found riddled with bullet holes.
We have sent a couple of officers out there to Cape Lisburn to investigate.
Andrea Medeiros with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says federal law limits walrus hunting to Alaskan native subsistence users. But the fact that some of the animals' tusks were harvested along with their usiks, that's the prized walrus penis bone, does not necessarily mean they were killed illegally.
We can't say, you know, with any certainty what, for one, the cause of death here was. You know, these animals from the photos do appear to have their heads taken off. And, you know, we can't make any assumptions that that's why they were killed, if they were in fact killed. You know, people certainly can take the heads if they find a dead walrus on the beach.
Hunting walrus purely for ivory and not harvesting the animal's meat is illegal under the 1972 Marine Mammal Protection Act. Steve Umitak is a subsistence whale and walrus hunter in Point Hope. He says bad ice conditions led to a poor spring walrus harvest this past year. That makes him and others in the community angry to see the walrus go to waste.
This kind of stuff we don't tolerate. You know, the animals have always been a food source for us. We were never taught to waste or anything like that. So we just want to get to the bottom of this and make sure that we find out what exactly happened. And they had gunshot wounds and everything, and the heads were gone, and somebody's doing something that should not ever be done.
The Eskimo Walrus Commission, based out of Nome, but with a commission member in Point Hope, is working jointly with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on the investigation. Reporting in Nome, I'm Matthew Smith.
Senator Lisa Murkowski on Thursday challenged National Park and Park Service officials about the fees they collect from visitors. At a Senate hearing, Murkowski said she generally supports the law allowing the agencies to collect fees. The 10-year-old law requires that most of the revenue is spent on things like visitor centers, maintenance, and public safety. But then Murkowski homed in on the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center in Juneau. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
The Forest Service is raising the entrance fee at Mendenhall from $3 to $5 starting in May. Murkowski says the increase is reasonable, but she was leery of plans to expand the fee area beyond the visitor's center.
If you want to bypass the visitor center, you don't want to go to the restroom, you don't even want to park your car. If you just want to go to the, and I'm just reading the article from the Juneau Empire here, if you just want to go to the Photo Point Trail, we're going to charge you the $5.
The senator says she worries the agencies are making public lands uninviting.
I don't want to go to my Mendenhall Visitor's Center and go hiking on the great trails that we have out there and feel like I'm going to have somebody from Forest Service who's going to be chasing me down the trail to pull up my multiple rain jackets to see if I've got a wristband on.
Yeah, not only are we not going to chase them down trails, but our real focus is going to be on trying to get our community to support us more in the future by delivering things for this fee that they'll support.
John Neary, director of the Mendenhall Glacier Visitors Center, wasn't at the hearing, but he says he's concerned about preserving the visitor experience, too. He says 90% of the 500,000 visitors the park expects next year will have already paid their fee through a commercial tour operator. For those who arrive on their own, enforcement will be sporadic, and Neary doesn't envision asking any hikers to roll up their sleeves.
In the past, we've used wristbands. We'd like to get away from that for a variety of reasons. One is that they increase our costs to both issue them, and I think a lot of people do find them annoying.
Neary says visitors won't be charged to use most trails, only those the Forest Service has invested money in, like Photo Point Trail, which is paved. User fees help maintain those improvements, and the center director says Mendenhall needs more amenities.
Right now, women that come out on a cruise and take a bus out here on a Monday afternoon typically have to wait 15 or 20 minutes online to use our restroom block, and that's unacceptable.
Neary says the visitor fees will help pay for new bathrooms, since they can't rely solely on funds from Congress. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The University of Alaska Board of Regents this week is meeting in Juneau. Among the topics up for discussion is figuring out how the university should move forward in a progressively bleaker fiscal climate and develop a plan of attack for their legislative budget requests. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
As state funding continues to decrease, the University of Alaska has typically relied on formulaic across-the-board cuts applied on a campus-by-campus basis. This year, however, Regent Gloria O'Neill says the board is adopting a different approach.
So instead of looking at specific campuses, really looking at the entire system and saying, what's important to us? What are our strategic goals? And then what are the costs around that and how well are we doing?
The Board of Regents plans to bring in higher education experts from around the country who have recently dealt with the same types of issues as a way to guide the university's evaluation and budgetary process. University President Jim Johnson says the State Office of Management and Budget is planning for a 4.8% or $15 million reduction for the university in the next fiscal year. Taking the looming drop in state funding into account, Johnson says the capital budget request in front of the Board of Regents takes a modest, focused approach in outlining university priorities.
The preliminary word from OMB is there will be no deferred maintenance this year. Completion of the UAF engineering building is of paramount importance for us. We've included no funding here for planning and design of new facilities.
Johnson says OMB also indicated it's unlikely there will be funding available for the UAF engineering building, which is partially built awaiting funding for its final phase of construction. The proposed capital budget asks for $134.8 million in state funding, over $37 million more than last year's request. Johnson also outlined the priorities of the proposed operating budget, rounding out at nearly $377.8 million.
We've placed a very high priority on faculty and staff compensation in this request and other fixed cost increases, new building operating costs, journal subscriptions, for example, unfunded compliance mandates. We take these extremely seriously.
The proposed request is just shy of $4 million more than last year's request to the legislature and about $27 million more than was actually appropriated for the current operating budget. The Board of Regents plans to finalize its budget request to the legislature at its November meeting. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, adapting roller derby for kids in Juneau.
Doesn't matter how tall you are, short you are, how big you are. Everybody has a secret roller derby superpower. It's just figuring out what it is and unlocking it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Well over a century ago, United Methodist Church members started the Jesse Lee Home in Unalaska for children who had been orphaned by disease or needed care while their parents recovered from illness. When the Spanish influenza pandemic wiped out villages along coastal Alaska, the home moved to Seward. And after the 1964 earthquake, it moved again to Anchorage. 125 years later, Alaska Child and Family, the contemporary to the Jesse Lee facility, is celebrating their anniversary this week. Dennis McCarville is president and CEO of the organization. He says the home still has residential facilities, but the goal is to reunite children with their families. He says the organization started to transition to its current form when it moved to Anchorage.
The staff recognized that that there were children that had mental health issues, primarily due to the trauma that they'd experienced in their life. And so there was a clinical component added, and that was starting in the late 60s.
The home has gone from the Jesse Lee Home to Alaska Children's Services, and it is now the Alaska Child and Family. How does this current iteration, Alaska Child and Family, differ from the Jesse Lee Home, and how is it the same?
Well, first of all, the obvious, we've added family into our name. It is because we really do believe that we are not just serving the child, but we're serving the families as well. And that's not a new thing. That's certainly been part of us for many, many years. And I believe that even if you look back to certainly the Seward days, there was also an emphasis on, trying to reunite children with their families. And that's certainly a strong part of who we are. Our goal is to have every child that we serve go back home if they are out of the home. And if we serve them in their home, our goal is to keep them there and not have them need to leave home for treatment.
Are you mainly providing services for young people in South Central, or do you have people come from other places in the state?
We serve children from all over the state. One of the things that we are initiating now, have been for the last year and a half, is trying to reach out to children that are off the road system. We find it very troubling to think that the children and families have to suffer so much off the road system to even get services. So we are working to set up treatment foster homes in the Bethel area and up the Kuskokwim River. And if we can be successful there, we'll look out elsewhere. But at this point, that's where we're working. We certainly serve children from that area in our Anchorage programs, but we'd really like to get off the road system and really help children and families where they are instead of having to come to Anchorage.
Dennis McCarville is the president and CEO of Alaska Child and Family. A multi-denominational worship service happens tomorrow at 4 p.m. at the First United Methodist Church, followed by a silent auction and celebration at the ConocoPhillips building in downtown Anchorage. Fairbanks' annual Equinox Marathon is tomorrow. A hilly, mostly off-road course and wet, cool weather make the race a challenge, but a few participants in this year's event are battling a much tougher foe. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Fairbanks runner Caroline Brown's son has a rare genetic disorder that's robbing him of his hearing and sight. Brown is part of a group of runners taking on this year's Equinox Marathon in support of developing treatments and even a cure for Usher syndrome.
Use the symbolism of the equinox in the balance of light and dark to raise awareness and also funds about Usher syndrome as the leading cause of combined deafness and blindness.
Brown and several other members of the Usher Syndrome Coalition are participating in the Equinox as part of the first ever Usher Syndrome Awareness Day and what they're calling Own the Equinox.
It's really an international effort at both awareness and support. And Marco here is actually from Germany.
About 2.5 years ago, I started a charity organization called Athletes for Charity.
Marco Stefan is running the marathon, guiding a friend from Boston who has Usher syndrome.
Together, attached with a string, and I found a company that supports the run. They're going to donate at least 25 euros for each kilometer.
Stefan and Brown are taking sponsorships and donations in hope of raising $50,000 for Usher syndrome research. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Juneau Roller Girls are training a co-ed junior league this fall. Roller derby is characterized by fast-paced bouts, slick moves, and cheeky alter egos. Helmets are essential. But as KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins discovered, the raucous sport can be adapted for kids.
At the Zach Gordon Youth Center, Kim Champney is skating backwards. She holds the hands of a young skater to help with the girls' balance and demonstrates the utility of a wrist guard.
I can slam my hand down and it doesn't hurt at all. That's kind of
the idea. It's like a helmet for your hand.
Exactly.
On Juno's adult roller derby team, Champney is what you call a jammer.
My derby name is Combustible.
During bouts, she tries to lap the opposing team's blockers. A blocker's job is to stop the jammer from getting through.
And you can do this by knocking them over or getting in front of them, kind of physically moving people around the track.
The 10 to 14-year-old co-ed league will start out a little differently. There won't be any physical contact to begin with. Players will have to work their way up to that. But Champney admits roller derby may have an image to overcome.
Because back in the 70s, it was kind of like the World Wrestling Federation or whatever. It was very staged and dramatic, and people were knocking people over. And even the movie Whip It, that's been part of the resurgence, overemphasized the violent part of it.
Initially, she says the kids will learn the basics, how to skate, how to stop, and how to go backwards. By the time they're doing more advanced moves like blocking, they'll have a strong foundation.
I've played for 5 years. I've never had a critical injury. My daughter is going to be part of roller derby, and I really feel that there's a big safety aspect.
Just a few weeks ago, an international derby association announced it was trying to unite junior leagues. Adult teams have already cropped up in nearly every Southeast community, and Champney thinks more kids' leagues are to follow. The Juneau Roller Girls were inspired last spring after watching kids from Seattle play.
They were leaps and bounds ahead of the adults, and some of the roller girls there, we were talking about how it's lucky we're skating now, because 10 years from now, when there's been established junior programs, we won't be able to compete.
Do you want to see the microphone?
Stephanie Cruz rolls around on skates with a toddler on her hip. Her derby name is Titan Young.
And Luke's roller derby name is Slingshot. His mom is Catapult Kim. So he's Slingshot.
Cruz says she's excited to teach. Derby's the first organized sport she's played, and it's taught her a lot. One of the takeaways she thinks could be valuable for kids is body confidence.
Doesn't matter how tall you are, short you are, how big you are. Everybody has a secret roller derby superpower. It's just figuring out what it is and unlocking it.
As the recruiting begins, Kim Champney says the kids can put their own spin on things, coming up with derby names and a fierce team logo.
We want to make it kid-led. So, I think any youth who's interested in getting in on the ground floor can really help us shape that.
Petersburg's Rockin' Blockers might have some competition. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Raven Alaska, connecting Alaska's business travelers across the state for more than 50 years. Find more at flyraven.com.
These days, being into STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, doesn't make a girl a geek, it makes the world a better place. If you like numbers, nature, computers, and figuring out how the world really works, go to beanengineeralaska.com. You just might like what you learn. And it's not just for girls. This message on Alaska Public Media brought to you by ExxonMobil in Alaska.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, Road Relay. Last weekend, nearly 1,600 people ran a 10-part race from Skagway over the Coast Mountains and into Whitehorse, Yukon. It's part endurance trial, part road trip, and part party. For many on both sides of the border, running the 110-mile Klondike Road Relay is an annual tradition. This year, KTOO's Jeremy Shea ran the Klondike for his first time, with a microphone clipped to his hydration pack.
The race begins on Skagway's historic main drag, Broadway, in front of an idling steam locomotive blocking off the street.
2 minutes! 2 minutes!
My team is starting around dusk. Amid the Gold Rush era buildings and dwindling light, glow sticks are cracking to life, and runners are warming up, some in costume. Brian Vandernald is running our team's first leg, which is 8.8 miles long.
The beer might have been a bad idea.
Or the best idea ever.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Brian cruises through his leg while two carloads of us hopscotch ahead to cheer him on in the dark at regular intervals.
Oh, oh, oh. Gracias.
We're howling and wearing plush wolf hats because our team is named Wolf Taco. There's not much of a story behind the name. Someone suggested it and no one objected.
Ooh. Oh, oh.
I'm up next. Leg 2 is the Klondike's shortest at 5.6 miles, but also the steepest. At the checkpoint, waiting for Brian, I'm anxious, worried that I'll be way off pace, that I'm overdressed and will overheat, and that I've misplaced my microphone in the dark for this story. I asked the Klondike veterans on my team for some last-minute advice.
Go that way fast.
Yep.
Don't uphill. Always gets run in your uphill. Way.
It's a relentless climb up to White Pass. There are no flats or saddles, just one short downhill after the summit, near the checkpoint to leg 3. There is one thing putting me at ease.
Oh, I'm just glad it's not raining.
But 1 mile later...
Oh, it's raining. Now it's raining.
And did I mention I'm asthmatic? Another mile goes by in the dark. As one runner passes me, she says...
God, this leg sucks.
Yeah.
It's actually beautiful in the day, but it's 10 o'clock at night, and we can only see a few feet of the highway in front of us. Near the end of my leg, at about 3,000 feet elevation, I've literally run above the rain clouds. Sky opens up to a zillion stars, and in front of me, I track the red taillights of a car up and over the horizon that I can't otherwise make out, Christopher Columbus style. My checkpoint is just on the other side, downhill. I'm soaked at the finish and try to keep warm around a fire barrel. The weather clears up, and about 5 hours later, our fifth runner and team captain, Corey McCrill, finishes an epic leg under the northern lights.
I've heard over the years lots of lore about running those middle-of-the-night legs on the Klondike and seeing northern lights, but every year before this that I've done it has been totally cloudy and I've never seen anything like that, so this was really awesome.
Corey's got quite the legacy. His dad, Mike McCrill, just finished his 29th Klondike. We hand the race over to the Wolf Taco Dawn team and sneak in a few hours of sleep at a noisy campground. When I wake up, it's fall in the Yukon. Our last runner crosses the finish line around 3 p.m. Yukon time. After a long soak in Tahkeena Hot Springs, we pile into a hotel room to discuss highs and lows from our runs over some victory bourbon. Sarah Bronstein is a Klondike veteran. This time, she ran leg 4, which is 13 miles.
I love passing people. And I got to pass lots of people. And I was feeling really good until Corey gave me my second gel packet at mile 7. And it just did not sit well with me. And there was some adversity that I had to overcome.
Adversity is a euphemism that Wolf Taco picked up. Sarah climbed down into a canyon to take care of business.
But even this turned into a bonus because then I got to go back up onto the road and chase down all of the people that I had just passed and pass them again.
Oh my God.
All the same people. It was great.
Our final time was 17 hours, 48 minutes, 11 seconds. Just shy of the winning time by about 7 hours. Better luck next year? From the Klondike Highway, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Sean Nielsen, who lives in Gustavus. He works part-time as a park ranger in Glacier Bay National Park, boarding cruise ships a few times a week to talk with tourists.
We bump up against the side of the ship, and they've already got a hatch open at that point, lower down on the ship, and they drop a rope ladder to us, and then we scramble on up. It's about 6 or 7 steps, and in the morning time, sometimes people come out and watch us, but it's usually around 6 o'clock in the morning. But in the afternoon when we go home, there's hundreds of people out on the edge of the rail there waving goodbye to us and to watch us climb back down the ladder at the end of the day. Yeah, we spend the full day on the ship, get in on the morning and get off on the afternoon. And we our main job is to share the park, Glacier Bay, with the folks and help them make a connection to it. My favorite part about the job is probably the fact that the Glacier Bay is so different every day. We go up and do the same route and see the same glaciers and come back, but each day is different. There's different wildlife, different scenery, different things happening. And of course, the people are always very interesting with lots of questions. After the cruise season shuts down at the end of September, I kind of hunker down here in Gustavus. And I live here with my wife and 2 young children. And we do a fairly consistent, well, we live a subsistence lifestyle where we hunt and fish and gather things, berries, and have a big garden. And that's one of my favorite times of the year, kind of when the season ends and everything really slows down, and my friends and everyone, we finally start to see each other after the really busy tourist season. In Gustavus, the cell phone coverage is very spotty. There is not very good internet service here, and that is also spotty. And that's a challenge, but it's also somewhat of a blessing, I suppose. It forces us all to slow down and live a life that's not quite as fast-paced and hectic as the rest of the world. Although we might want it, it might not help us.
Sean Nielsen lives in Gustavus. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio, and we want to hear from you. Sean wrote us with his story. If you want to do the same, we'd love to hear from you. Send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Jeremy Shea and Annie Fite. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matthew Smith in Nome, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Josh Edge in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. There is still time to start the Business Administration and Management program at Alaska Pacific University. Module 2 courses start on Wednesday, October 21st. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.